Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm, but Diane is going to be back on Monday. She's really looking forward to being back in this chair and talking with all of you, her loyal listeners. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi warns there is little support in Congress for spending more American troops in Afghanistan. The U.S. State Department rejects Iran's latest proposal for international talks. And an update on global terrorism 8 years after the September 11th attacks. Joining me for a roundup of this week's international news, Karen DeYoung of The Washington Post, Abderrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera Arabic, and Susan Glasser with Foreign Policy Magazine. Welcome to you all. Good morning. And you can join us as well. 1-800-433-8850, drshow@wamu.org is our email address. We're also available on Twitter, Facebook. Tell us your thoughts and your questions, and we'll get to them. Susan, let's start with the fact that this is 9/11. It is year 8 after the attacks on the United States. Barack Obama has made a number of speeches this summer saying Afghanistan is essential. It's a war that is essential to American security. Because this is the place where the 9/11 attacks were planned, and this could be a place where future attacks on the United States could be planned. And yet, this week, Speaker Pelosi saying there is declining support in the U.S. Congress for more troops. Senator Levin, chairman of Foreign of the Armed Services Committee, going to make a speech today saying some similar things. Give us your take on American support for the president's Afghan policy.
Well, I think it's been particularly striking. In a way, it was overlooked, perhaps in the summer doldrums, that President Obama did make this speech and he called Afghanistan a war of necessity. And I think what we're starting to see now is the growing reaction among really his core liberal progressive wing of support, which is starting increasingly vocally to stand up and to say, you know, this isn't what we signed up for. You know, we're so focused perhaps on how do we get out of Iraq that we haven't really focused until now on the idea that we're going to be potentially significantly stepping up our footprint in Afghanistan. President Obama really has staked out a position, I think, that will be hard for him to pull away from, despite these growing concerns from his left flank. And, you know, probably the next step will be a real confrontation that starts to gel around the recommendations of General Stanley McChrystal, the new commander for the effort in Afghanistan. And I think that's when Obama is going to face, you know, arguably one of his first major foreign policy challenges.
Now, Abderrahim, Senator Levin today will make the point. He just came back from Afghanistan, and he said what is necessary rather than more American troops is bolstering the Afghan native forces, both the military and the police. There's echoes of our Iraq policy there, too, which has been the prescription in Iraq as well. Give us your take of the situation on the ground in Afghanistan. Over the summer, people were using words of like disintegrating and increasingly unstable. What do we know?
Well, I mean, I think there's a consensus that the situation on the ground in Afghanistan has deteriorated, even by the standards and the admission of the United States government. We've heard that statement made by various people here in Washington, including Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. There was some hope fed by the election that happened in Afghanistan. Before the election happened, there were some hopes pinned on that election in terms of helping Hamid Karzai and therefore helping the Obama administration sort of get a handle on the situation in Afghanistan. The election has been, in the eyes of a lot of people, much more controversial. Its results have been much more controversial than originally anticipated, certainly by the Obama administration. And that's going to make the task of the Obama administration dealing with Afghanistan very tough indeed.
Let me follow up on that, because one of the developments this week, the International Commission that has been monitoring the counting of that election, whereas Hamid Karzai seemed to have, Karen, about 54% of the vote, but just yesterday a decision was made to throw out a number of voting places where there seemed to be pretty blatant evidence of fraud. And pick up on Abderrahim's point, the lack of a clear and credible winner is really an important part of the mix here.
I think this is a far bigger problem for the Obama administration strategy than their acknowledged problems with Congress. I believe that if you look at what Senator Levin said, he sort of staked out a position that allows him to have it both ways. He said, I believe that the Afghan security forces should be vastly increased, and I acknowledge that probably will take some more troops to train them and to mentor them. What that means is U.S. units going out with Afghan units, which is what they're doing now. And I think that when the administration presents its decisions about General McChrystal's assessment, they will do it in such a way as to not come out and say, well, and therefore we're sending 20,000 more troops. That may exactly be the end result, something close to that. But they will say, we're adjusting this, adjusting that. We're going to come up with a new program here, sticking with our basic strategy, and it'll be much more nuanced than that. But again, their big problem is not having a partner in Afghanistan. The Electoral Commission, as you said yesterday, threw out the results from 83 polling stations. These were primarily in the north, in the south and in the southeast, which are President Karzai's.
So there is an increasing possibility of a runoff election if Karzai does not have 50%, right?
I'm not so sure. I mean, I think that Karzai probably will end up with 50% plus one, but it will take a very long time.
But would that be a credible result? Would that create a strong central leader with authority, or would that be a reflection of weakness?
Well, that's the problem. And I think that in the administration, they're racking their brains to come up with some kind of compromise that would allow some of the other candidates to have prominent places in the government, which those candidates have said they're not interested in doing.
Susan, let me pick up on another point here, which is stepping back. As you point out, the president over the summer very forcefully saying this was a war of necessity. But it's predicated on the argument that there are people in the mountains of Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, who not only are plotting against the United States, but have the means of delivering another blow. Today on 9/11, 8 years later, give us an update on that situation. President Bush said, I'm going to get Osama bin Laden dead or alive, never did. What do we know about the potential threat of terrorists against the United States who are located in Afghanistan?
Well, you know, I think this is actually often an overlooked piece of the conversation, because it is the predicate, arguably, for why Obama has defined this as a war of toys. And, you know, if you look at the U.S. Intelligence estimates that have come out recently, you know, the argument is that this is very much, I think the word was resilient and still existing force. There's a lot of debate among terrorism experts of what exactly does that mean, central al-Qaeda versus the movement that it spawned, for example. But I think it's pretty clear that a new generation of leaders has emerged to carry the banner of actual jihad as well as just virtual. Clearly there's a whole internet space that exists here. We have a fascinating piece on our website today, foreignpolicy.com, about one such potential future leader of al-Qaeda, a guy who comes from Libya, who fought there, who was actually imprisoned by the U.S. in Bagram, escaped in a very dramatic escape several years ago, has become sort of a global jihad figure over the last few years using the internet and that sort of thing.
And Abderrahim, at the same time, there has been a growing body of argument, Richard Haass of the Council of Foreign Relations, among others, saying if the real national interest there is containing terrorism as opposed to nation building or women's rights or other benefits of a vast American presence, this can be done through drone attacks, better intelligence, local forces, so that this is part of the growing debate, is it not?
It really is, and it's going to be a very difficult circle to square for the Obama administration. I mean, talking about a war of necessity in Afghanistan, even other than the fact that when the Bush administration decided to go to war, it was accused of diverting attention from Afghanistan. For Barack Obama to come back now and say several years later that this is still a war of necessity in Afghanistan, I think that doesn't hold a lot of water, not for many Americans, and certainly not for many people out there in the region.
Two other issues in Afghanistan this week, Karen. One was the bombing of a fuel truck on the order of German forces. People forget that there are a lot of NATO forces that are not Americans based in Afghanistan. The governor, Angela Merkel, is getting a lot of heat on this. Give us your take on that dimension of the story.
As has been said, there's growing anti-war sentiment in this country, but still at a relatively low level compared to what it is in Europe. Certainly in Britain, certainly in Germany, and growing in France, all of which have large numbers of troops in Afghanistan. It's always been a point of contention between the Americans and some of the Europeans, the Germans in particular, who have lots of restrictions on their presence there that say that they're not supposed to be engaged in combat. They're primarily in the north of Afghanistan, where there hasn't been a lot of combat. There hasn't been a lot of Taliban, but there is an increasing Taliban presence there, including the group that hijacked these fuel trucks that were going through the German-run territory last week. The tankers were bogged down. The Germans called in an airstrike. Only the Americans do airstrikes in Afghanistan. A lot of civilians were killed. The German public had yet another reason to say, what are we doing there in the first place? A lot of questions raised and investigations ongoing about the why the strike was called in the first place, since there have been new regulations to avoid killing civilians.
It's Karen DeYoung of The Washington Post. Abderrahim Fukar is with me from Al Jazeera. Susan Glasser from Foreign Policy Magazine. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in for Diane. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in today for Diane. As always, on Friday, our second hour, the international segment of our news roundup. Karen DeYoung of The Washington Post is with me. Abderrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera. Susan Glasser with Foreign Policy Magazine. And before we move on to other countries, let's ask one more question about Afghanistan. Susan, this dramatic rescue of a New York Times reporter, Stephen Farrell, this week, but his Afghani interpreter was killed, and a lot of recriminations after this episode.
Well, that's right. First of all, it was an absolute tragedy. This is a young man, 34 years old, who since the very beginning, since the U.S. invasion that followed 9/11, had been working with the New York Times in Afghanistan. He literally risked his life over and over again to tell the story. He had actually gone to Germany to study. He could have built a new life in the West. He chose just a few months ago to remain in Afghanistan, to come back. He said, I would rather work in my country sweeping the streets than I would to work in some safe restaurant in Germany. And, of course, he was killed literally, seconds before being rescued. It's a real tragedy. And I think it also spotlights some of the other things that we're talking about, which is the increasing deterioration of the situation on the ground in Afghanistan. This is a province in the north that until recently had not had a significant Taliban footprint. I was really interested that there was a new assessment out today that suggests that up to 80% of Afghanistan now has a significant permanent Taliban presence, according to one assessment. That's up dramatically from just 54% a couple years ago. And I think, you know, whatever the precise number is, this is a place where the ground situation is changing, and it's changing in the favor of the Taliban.
You know, those of us who have been foreign correspondents and covered wars as I have, the public doesn't understand how deeply we depend as journalists on local help as translators, as arrangers, as negotiators, as protectors. And the United States press could not operate in Afghanistan or Iraq or so many other countries without these very heroic figures. And the loss this week of that translator just highlighted how important they are to a free press in the West. Abdarahim, let's move on to another country, Iran, in the news this week. American experts saying, in somewhat scary language, that Iran has moved closer to a potential breakthrough in developing nuclear weapons. This is not a new story. There's been an ongoing debate over how close Iran is, what their real intentions are. Iran says it's all for peaceful uses to create electricity. The West has generally been very suspicious of that explanation. What can you tell us about what we've learned new this week?
Well, first of all, the Iranian president, Ahmadinejad, has certainly been hobbled by the internal developments that we saw in Iran a few weeks ago. So he's clearly been weakened by that internal situation. But having said that, there's a general perception in the region that one fundamental difference between the Iranians and certainly the Iranian regime and the regime of Saddam Hussein, for example, when it existed in Iraq, is that the Iranians are much more tactile in terms of negotiating a deal with the West or with others. And certainly the timing of these moves that the Iranians keep making, it certainly shows that there is some truth to that claim, that they are very tactile in terms of trying to negotiate whatever they're trying to negotiate. But having said that, it seems to me that the West and Iran are on some level talking at cross purposes, because the West wants to, led by the United States, it wants to negotiate over Iran's intentions to build a nuclear weapon. The Iranians are saying, we are willing to negotiate, but we are not trying to build a nuclear weapon. We're willing to negotiate whatever you want to negotiate, but the ability of Iran to develop nuclear capability for peaceful purposes, as they say, is a non-negotiable. One final thing, which is, it seems to me, just listening to various voices in the Obama administration, it seems to me that the Obama administration is talking out of both sides of its mouth at the moment, because we have the U.S. ambassador to the IAEA in Vienna saying that the Iranians are very close to building a nuclear weapon. We have Gates, who's on the record, actually, in an interview with Al Jazeera a few days ago, saying that he does not think that the Iranians are as close as the U.S. ambassador to IAEA seems to think. And he seems to think that there is still room for diplomacy and economic sanctions to work.
Now, Karen, on that point, Barack Obama has taken a somewhat different tack toward Iran than its predecessor, indicating more willingness to negotiate. But there is also growing calls for if this attempt by six countries to negotiate with Iran does not work, to talk about sanctions. And yet this morning, a story out of Russia, Vladimir Putin's spokesman says that the Russian prime minister has warned against either the use of force or new sanctions against Iran. And without Russian cooperation, it's very difficult to get new sanctions through the United Nations.
I think this has always been a sort of bifurcated policy by the Obama administration. He spoke of extending an open hand instead of a clenched fist to countries like Iran. And so they have been making an attempt to reach out. At the same time, the sanctions procedure is continuing. They tried, the Bush administration at the very end tried several times to tighten the sanctions against Iran. Each time, the Russians said, don't even try because we won't go along with it. And if the Russians won't go along with it, that means the Chinese won't go along with it. And that is what's happening again. You saw this week.
And the French are not all excited about it.
Right. You saw this week that the Iranians put out a proposal, which they sent to the European and American negotiators or would-be negotiators, saying, look, let's all have a conference to talk about worldwide nuclear weapons problems. Didn't say anything about let's talk about us.
Right. As Abd Rahim said, they have really ruled out talks about their own nuclear ambitions.
And the Obama administration has sort of pointed out that it doesn't mention their principal problem, but has not totally closed the door. And I think that they're well aware that they have got to at least appear like they're open to any call for negotiations, but they are proceeding on this separate track to try and get support for sanctions, which the Russians now today have put them on notice that they haven't changed their position at all.
Now, Susan, the other dimension of the Russian statement wasn't just about sanctions; it was about military action. Another thing that happened this week: the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, apparently, we're not quite sure, I guess, made a mission to Moscow and with a more conservative Prime Minister in Israel, there is growing uneasiness in that country and growing talk that they might take matters into their own hands, as they have in the past, and perhaps attack Iran's nuclear installations. What do we know about Israel's role in this?
Well, you know, first of all, whatever it is that Prime Minister Netanyahu said to the Russians this week, it obviously was not persuasive on the point of Iran. You know, there was some speculation that perhaps this was an Iran-related trip. And, you know, I think
he's been very afraid that the Russians are selling air defense systems to Iran, among other things.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, there's long since, you know, this is perhaps the issue that bedeviled the Bush administration more than any other. And what's striking to see is that it's just roared right back. The dynamics haven't changed. Remember the famous reset button with Russia. Why did the Obama administration want to hit the reset button with Russia? Well, Iran was, you know, largely one of the key reasons they wanted to change the strategy there. If you talk to senior Bush people, I think many of them who were involved in this issue would call it one of their biggest frustrations and failures over the 8-year course of the Bush administration, that they were unable to really secure Russian follow-through. Many times there were commitments. We were covering this at the time. You know, every 6 months there would be a reliable, well, this time the Russians are really cooperating with us on Iran. You're going to see a new push on this. It never happened. The Obama folks, I think, are finding the same thing, which is that, you know, Russia is still Russia, and there has not been a reset button pushed on the subject of Iran.
Now, Abd Rahim, the other dimension of Iran that's important, as with Afghanistan, there was an election, and there is continuing fallout from that election. And this week, further indications that the leaders of Iran are going to do everything possible to quash dissent, including seizing documentary evidence of their previous repression. Give us a sense of what's going on.
Well, I mean, as I said earlier, what happened in Iran last month has certainly infused a certain measure of weakness into the system as a whole, the political system, into the political establishment in Iran. I think what's happened since those events, at least on the surface of it, became quieter, is that Ahmadinejad has obviously regained the initiative, and he's trying in all sorts of different ways to show that he's still got a handle on it. One way he will try to show that is obviously over the nuclear issue. And he's going to try and seem very strong in the confrontation, if there is confrontation with the West. You have the General Assembly coming up, and that's certainly going to be a theater stage, not just for Ahmadinejad, but for the Western powers as well, to demonstrate to the Iranians that the West has not backed down. It has not let people inside Iran who wanted change. It hasn't cut them loose. but it's also going to be an opportunity for Ahmadinejad to show his constituency back in Iraq, back in Iran, that he's doing the job that most Iranians want him to do, which is to project a strong Iran at the United Nations.
But he's also, it would seem, doing everything possible to quash the dissent domestically.
Absolutely. I mean, I think he's obviously going to be operating in a two-track mode. On the international stage, he's going to be doing everything he can to give Iranians back in Iran the feeling that he is, you know, looking out for their best interests. But internally, he's obviously going to be doing everything he can to try and at least partially cement the rift that we saw that appeared in the Iranian...
In the election.
During the election.
Karen, next door, Iraq continues almost every week. We have to talk about it. This week in Iraq, a blast in the northern provinces, 25 people or so killed. This is an area of a lot of ethnic strife, Kurds, Turkmens, Arabs. What do we know about the security situation in Iraq and the potential for widening civil strife there?
It's interesting that as these things have happened, and there have been several big explosions, certainly starting from the August 19th suicide attack against the foreign ministry in Baghdad, the Americans have gone out of their way in each instance to say, gosh, this is too bad, but we don't think it's a return to sectarian strife. We think things are proceeding as they should. We are leaving on schedule, if not before. We were scheduled to leave. And you saw Ambassador Chris Hill, the U.S. ambassador to Baghdad, was on Capitol Hill yesterday testifying in the Senate and in the House and saying, look, you know, this is essentially saying this is growing pains. The Iraqis have to learn how to deal with these things themselves, and they will learn how to do it by doing it.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. But in his testimony, the subtext clearly was drawing a very clear distinction between Iraq and Afghanistan. They continue to say Iraq is not vital to national security interests in the way that Afghanistan remains.
Well, he was saying, look, we have an ongoing interest in a partnership with Iraq. Iraq will, you know, we have this strategic framework agreement that has levels of economic cooperation, cultural cooperation, and some ongoing military cooperation, certainly in terms of training and other kinds of assistance, but that we are not, we think in terms of the insurgency, that's Iraq's problem now, and we're leaving it for them to deal with. Obviously, they still have problems in the north, and that is the primary concern, both on a military level, an economic level, and a governance level, the difficulties between the Kurds in the north and the Arabs and the Shiite-led government in Baghdad.
Now, Susan, also in the news this week in that part of the world, we mentioned Israel and its foreign policy issues with Iran. But there was also domestic developments which have international implications this week, where Prime Minister Netanyahu permitted expansion of settlements in the West Bank. Mm-hmm. Many people saying this was done to appease the conservative settler movement. The Obama administration has been very critical of this, and yet Israel went ahead anyway.
Well, that's right. I think this is a key moment between the new Obama team and the Netanyahu government. He tried to split the difference, to say we're going to allow this wave, but then we're going to prohibit future expansion. It was a compromise. It didn't satisfy anyone. I think it also crossed a bright line that the administration attempted to establish very early on, and it suggests that there's not really a meaningful chance at this moment to look for a new round of significant peace talks. I know there had been discussion that in September we would be looking at, you know, some kind of major new initiative. And, you know, I'm curious actually what our other guests think in terms of how much that's still going to be on the table at the UN General Assembly, for example.
I think very much it's definitely going to be on the table. Let me just quickly say that the issue of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's visit to Russia, it also harks back to the internal situation in Israel. As we know, Russian Jewry plays a very crucial role in the politics of Israel.
And they've been very strongly supportive of Likud, his party. Yes.
Exactly. So for him to actually go to Russia, the country where they originally hailed from, that's a symbolic gesture to Israeli Jews of Russian descent. Now, the issue with Barack Obama is really in a bind here, because he went to Cairo and he told the Arabs and the Muslim world at large that he wanted to start a new page in relations with the Muslim world. Crucial to those relations between the United States and the Muslim world is the issue of Palestine. At the same time, he so far, at least the signs are that he has not been able to put decisive pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu. The statement that came out of the White House a few days ago, it said that the Obama administration or President Obama regrets the decision by Prime Minister Netanyahu to allow building of settlements. But it also reiterated Obama's unshakable, as it said, support and commitment to the security of Israel. A lot of people in the region will be scratching their heads and saying, well, if you're so committed, then how can you put pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu?
I'm going to be back. I'm Steve Roberts sitting for Diane. We're going to be back with your call. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Frederica and Howard Stevenson, helping low-income students access education through the Summer Search Foundation at summersearch.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The new Fox comedy series Glee has started its first season after a pilot episode that aired last spring. It's about a high school choir of losers and its director. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the show's creator, Ryan Murphy. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Get down, girl, go ahead. Cutie the bomb, met her at a beauty salon with the baby Louis Vuitton under her underarm. She said, I can tell you wrong.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in today for Diane on our second hour on Friday, our international segment of the news roundup. Karen DeYoung of The Washington Post, Abderrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera, Susan Glasser with Foreign Policy Magazine. And let me read an email from Tim in Tamarack, Florida. He says, Afghanistan is not capitalized, a war of necessity. Terrorists are in Africa, Europe, Asia, even in North and South America. The terrorists are not a nation. Preventing the Talibanization of Afghanistan is not a key step to take in order to counter terrorism. It's a waste of life and resources. Susan, you were talking about this earlier in terms of the this sentiment is reflected in public opinion polls as well as some of the growing restiveness on Capitol Hill.
Well, that's right. There's clearly a building, if you will, liberal backlash against the war. You know, you're starting to see, in fact, some influential Bush-era conservatives. I think it was just a week ago that Karl Rove rounded up a group of familiar names, as it were, to say, well, we support the president. Clearly, they see the potential for sort of partisan trouble on Obama's base. And then on the other hand, you have this question of or really this argument over what constitutes a safe haven in this day and age for al-Qaeda. How can we limit it to the physical location of the border areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan? I was just thinking of this the other day, reading a very interesting piece on our site about Somalia, for example, the original safe haven. The U.S. has had a very minimal engagement with the country since its disastrous policy there in the 1990s. This is a country that has literally been without a functioning government for decades. It is almost the definition of a potential terrorist safe haven.
And the other point you were making earlier is that, and our caller and writer implies as well, is that terrorism just doesn't exist in a physical space. There's an international cyber network that exists almost independent of a physical location.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, look, you know, there was an influx of foreign fighters to Iraq at the moment when the energy and the perception and the recruitment, if you will, for a global jihad went to Iraq. There are clearly evidence of foreign fighters in the border regions of Afghanistan and Pakistan today. There's no question of that. This is, if you press in one area, these folks aren't just going to disappear. And I think it's, you know, that's a flawed assumption that you would think had been disabused by 9/11 itself.
You mentioned 9/11, and of course this is 9/11. And Hank in Dalton, Ohio, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show. I gather you want to talk about that subject as well.
Yes, good morning. This is a great segue into my comment and my question. Today we are, dare I use the word, celebrating or mourning 9/11, 8 years ago. However, what do your panelists believe we have learned about the causes of 9/11 and what that knowledge might do for us as we move forward to prevent worldwide terrorism? Let's not forget that many more people died in 9/11 than just Americans. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Hank, thanks so much. Abderrahim?
To me personally, I think that's an absolutely amazing question because it raises the issue of how Americans see the causes of 9/11 and how people in the Muslim world, for example, see the causes of 9/11. There's a lot of overlap in terms of how both sides see the causes of 9/11. But I think over the years, an argument here in the United States has developed that the causes of 9/11 are lack of democracy, for example, in the Muslim world, which helps breed discontent, and that discontent, because it has nowhere to air into the political system, it turns to violence and terrorism. In large parts of the Muslim world, a counter-argument has, if you will, has developed over the years, which is that United States foreign policy in the Middle East needs to be revised, and that the causes of discontent with U.S. foreign policy harks back to the issue of Israel and Palestine. President Barack Obama, I think he's trying to sort of find a compromise argument between the two. Whether he will be able to actually bridge the gap between those two arguments or not, we don't know. We know that he is quite capable of literally stretching the limits of human achievement in terms of what he did during the election. But the foreign policy challenge and 9/11 will clearly continue to be the subject of heated debate as far as the causes are concerned.
Now, Karen, George Bush, President 43 Bush, often spoke about the value of democracy as a way of bringing the Muslim world into a more peaceful and stable situation. And yet we saw this week one example of the fruits of democracy in Lebanon, where there was a defeat of Hezbollah, but the prime minister-designate was not able to form a government. In Gaza, an election brought Hamas to power. So that democracy is not always the the answer or the solution.
Well, that's true. And you look at the Lebanon situation. I mean, some would argue that this is democracy at work. Hezbollah got a lot of votes. We don't like it. A lot of other countries don't like it. Nobody has charged that the election was corrupt in any major kind of way. Our chosen leader there, Prime Minister Hariri, has resigned because he can't form a government. And so they're going to have to negotiate, and they're going to have to negotiate a government that reflects the actual outcome of the election. But I think to go back to lessons of 9/11, I mean, we did learn some domestic lessons about communication among intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies and the lack thereof. I think we learned that they weren't very good. I don't think we've learned necessarily how to perfect them in the way that we would like. But let's remember, too, that although Osama bin Laden has now kind of seized on the Israel-Palestinian issue to make it his own, because he, not being stupid, rightly recognizes that this is a way to garner more international support, certainly in the Islamic world. That didn't have much to do with his reasons in the start. I mean, he was objecting to a U.S. military presence in Saudi Arabia. I think that the Obama administration, while recognizing that the Israel-Palestinian issue, as was said here, is a place where he really needs to start and to become more involved and try to alter policy, he's found, as every other president has before him, that's a very, very difficult thing to do.
Let's turn to Jennifer in southeastern Ohio. Jennifer, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hello. It's such an honor to talk to you people. You know, this is 9/11, all right, and it's a very, very sad day. But, you know, they said all the terrorists that were on those planes were Saudi Arabians. I don't know how we picked Afghanistan or Iraq, you know, it just amazes me, you know, that they didn't do that. And remember those men standing on that lamppost going, yay? Those were Israeli intelligence.
Okay, so Jennifer, thanks very much. This issue of the attackers on 9/11 were, in fact, Saudi, not Afghani. Respond to Jennifer's point.
Well, I think there's no real doubt at this point that the attacks were conceived and largely funded and directed by the al-Qaeda leadership that had its presence and its home in an Afghanistan that was ruled by the Taliban. I don't think that's in dispute at this point 8 years later. Clearly, the Bush administration's decisions in the aftermath of 9/11, in particular, actually the invasion of Iraq, and the efforts to link it, despite what later emerged to be very little to no evidence whatsoever, to an al-Qaeda presence. That's going to be debated by historians and politicians for generations to come. But I don't think there remains a similar question mark, as the caller suggested incorrectly.
Let's turn to Suzanne in Rochester, New York. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Suzanne.
Thank you. I have one comment and a question. I think it's laughable and sad at the same time that Netanyahu would think that he could go any place and ask anybody for anything, given that he stuck his finger in the eye of both friends and foes, including the United States. My question is regarding Afghanistan. I haven't heard mentioned, and I wish you could comment, on the fact that there seems to be a good partner in Pakistan. I could be all wrong on this, my whole perspective, but they seem to be a good partner in that they are responding to the same thing, really, that we are. And they have a standing army, a very competent standing army, and seem willing to do this. So I wonder if you could comment on that.
Thank you, Suzanne. Abderrahim, obviously Pakistan plays a very critical role. Historically, of course, Pakistani intelligence services have had close relations with the Taliban. It's not quite as simple as Suzanne makes it out, but please answer her comment.
As far as the accusations to Pakistani intelligence doing business behind everybody's back with the Taliban Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, in the interview that he did with Al Jazeera a few days ago, addressed that point. He basically put those accusations to rest. He unreservedly expressed support for the government of Pakistan, both the civilian government and the military. And he said literally that the government of Pakistan, military and civilian, and the government of the United States are all in the same trench, and they all have the same goal, which is to defeat the Taliban in both Pakistan and Afghanistan, in addition to Al-Qaeda. But here's the rub. The rub is that in that part of the world, if you express support for the government of Pakistan, it could almost be the kiss of death to that government as far as popular support in Pakistan. So that is the conundrum that the Obama administration faces in Pakistan. Having a government that is dependable from their point of view and lauding that government as being dependable from the point of view of the United States really creates trouble for that government with its own public opinion. So where do you go from there?
Right. Let's go to Kathleen in Dayton, Ohio. You're on the Diane Rehm Show. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks. Hey, I want to thank the Rehm Show first for bringing up the illegal settlement issue, because no one like David Gregory, Keith Olbermann, Rachel Maddow, they don't touch it. But anyway, you know, we all know that prior to the invasion of Iraq, the head of the IAEA, El-Baradei, came out and told the world early in March that the Niger documents were false and bad documents at that. And now we've had the former head, El-Baradei, of the IAEA, and the present head, tell us that there's no hard evidence to back up the endlessly repeated and substantiated claims that Iran has or is after nuclear weapons program. Yet I hear some of those same talking heads, David Gregory, Chris Matthews, Rachel Maddow, allow people to come on their programs and repeat these unsubstantiated claims. So when are we going to hear these people challenge, you know, Cheney and whoever else comes on and repeats these claims, Bill Kristol? When are we going to hear those in the MSM challenge those claims? Didn't we learn anything from that run-up?
Thank you very much, Kathleen. I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Karen, you have an answer.
Well, I think that that Al-Baradei and the IAEA are under some restraints to say what they know factually and what falls within their writ. What they have said is Iran has not allowed us access to those places that we believe we need access to, and therefore we cannot confirm their contention that they do not have a weapons program. Obviously, other governments are not under those constraints. They have their own intelligence services. They have their own self-interest that colors what they say, but they find it necessary and believe that that the Iranians are enriching uranium to the point where it is possible to use it in a nuclear weapon. And so I don't think that there's not a whole lot. You don't hear a lot of dispute from the IAEA about that. But the IAEA, within its own writ, is mandated to do certain investigations and come out with certain findings, which they're doing.
Let's turn to Tim in St. Louis, Missouri. Tim, you're on the Diane Rehm Show. Welcome.
Good morning. My question is that, considering that the people who attacked us 8 years ago today were based in Afghanistan, what is your assessment of the Bush administration's decision to divert resources away from Afghanistan in order to invade Iraq, and how has that affected the situation that President Obama inherited?
Thank you very much, Tim. Susan?
Well, I think there's little dispute. Certainly, very, very senior officers in the military have spoken very eloquently over the last year about the deteriorating situation in Afghanistan, the fact that they do not believe adequate resources or attention were paid to Afghanistan. In many ways, what's most striking, in fact, today, 8 years after 9/11, is that we are continuing to have many of the same conversations about Afghanistan that you would have imagined at the very beginning of a conflict. In a way, despite all the billions of dollars, despite the thousands of lives that have been killed, civilians and military personnel, not only from the U.S., but from many other countries, we're now reinventing the Afghan conflict all over again. And for people who've had continuous war in their country since 1979, that's a pretty terrible legacy of 9/11.
But there does seem, Karen, to be a growing war fatigue in this country. The mood on Capitol Hill is clearly increasingly sour in regards to Afghanistan, particularly among Democrats.
There's no question about that, but I also think just as nothing succeeds like success, nothing fails like failure. And you saw the progression of events over the year. President Obama announced his new strategy the end of March. Throughout the summer, this ended up to be the worst year ever for the military coalition in Afghanistan. More U.S. troops killed, more European troops killed, more Taliban attacks. And I think people are saying, wait a minute, you have a new strategy. You were going to do things differently. Why is it things are getting worse? Well, there are a lot of reasons why things are getting worse that don't necessarily have to do with President Obama's strategy. The administration would argue, give us time. It hasn't started to work yet. Others would say the Taliban have been at this for a long time. They've gotten a lot better at it. But I think the president needs to do a much better job of explaining why we're there and what the association is with al-Qaeda.
And Abdarahim, quickly, final word. You expect General McChrystal to ask for more troops, and will Congress approve that request?
I think all the indications are that he will ask for more troops to basically be able to secure the security gains that the U.S. military makes in Afghanistan. To what extent the Congress will give him everything he needs in terms of those troops. We know from past experiences that the Congress finds it difficult to say no in those cases.
That's Abdarahim Fukara from Al Jazeera Arabic, Karen DeYoung of The Washington Post, Susan Glasser with Foreign Policy Magazine. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm, but she's going to be back in this chair on Monday. Thanks so much for spending part of your Friday with us.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.